Hello and welcome to Meandering with Myrn, a potpourri of podcasts by me, veterinary ethologist Myrn Milani. Join me as I ponder any and all things animal and human, what we know and what we don't, where we've been, where we are, and where we're headed. One of the chores on my do list when I got back home from Colorado was to try to catch up on my journal reading. And one of the articles that caught my attention was entitled Hyperphosphatemia and Concurrent Adrenal Gland Dysfunction in Apparently Healthy Scottish Terriers. The title caught my attention for several reasons. First, the fact that Scottish Terriers might have a higher incidence of hyperphosphatemia and concurrent adrenal problems didn't surprise me based on what I knew about these animals from my behavioral practice and knowing them on a social level. They seem perfect candidates for this type of problem. But the article also intrigued me, as articles in medical journals do, because I was curious about how they defined apparently healthy Scottish Terriers. I discovered that they described it exactly as you would expect people who are fully locked into the medical view to do so. The dogs were considered to be healthy based on the usual strictly medical criteria: physical examination, medical history review, complete blood count, routine physical biochemical tests, and urinalysis. In addition to the 17 dogs who were deemed to be healthy Scottish Terriers, there were also 17 dogs who were chosen who had hyperphosphatemia. Then the study goes on to describe how the animals also were showing evidence of early adrenal problems, specifically hyperactivity of the adrenal glands, hyperadrenal corticism. The researchers were surprised to find that all but one dog also had normal-sized adrenal glands, even though there was evidence of hyperadrenal activity. Their conclusion was that this was associated with a subclinical change in the adrenal glands or in the pituitary glands or in one of the other physiological parameters that are associated with excessive adrenal gland activity. And finally, in terms of conclusions, that hyperphosphatemia was a benign condition, but these animals bared watching because this condition could evolve into full-blown hyperadrenal corticism and or liver dysfunction. It seems so straightforward, doesn't it? Of course, if you look at it from the perspective of the bond and behavior, it's not so straightforward at all. For example, the idea that those animals were apparently healthy, very, very limited definition of healthy, strictly based on physical health. Until proven otherwise, it's possible that those animals were experiencing a certain amount of what could be considered abnormal stress in their respective environments. Maybe there were dogs who went berserk every time the doorbell rang. Maybe they were aggressive. Maybe they were nippy, you know, maybe they didn't like the mailman, maybe they didn't like the UPS guy. Maybe they didn't like thunderstorms, maybe they didn't like cats. Maybe there was a lot of stress in the household, maybe the relationship between the owners was falling apart. Maybe there was tension between parents and offspring. And every time the dog was stressed, the dog secreted stress hormones, the majority of which are steroid hormones, and that put pressure on the adrenal glands. But at the time these studies were done, the dog could compensate for that stress, and the only sign of it was an elevation in alkaline phosphatase. And so the conclusion was, well, let's just sit on it. Let's sit on it and let's wait and see what happens. And then when it gets really bad, then we'll treat it medically. But until then, it's benign. It's physiologically benign. It doesn't mean anything. We'll just wait and see. Or maybe the researchers or veterinarians will say to the owner, well, your dog's alkaline phosphatase is elevated, but the dog's healthy. So let's just wait and see. No need to change anything. We'll just wait and see. Now, some people might say, okay, and shrug it off. But other people might worry. They might worry that there is some sort of time bomb ticking somewhere inside of their dog. And now, maybe they become even more reactive than they were before. And before, it was their reactivity and the dog's response to their reactivity that was triggering this whole physiological change in the first place. And now we wind up in a self-fulfilling prophecy. I can appreciate the science behind strictly medical studies that ignore the role that behavior in the animal's physical and emotional environment play in its health. And I can appreciate the science behind strictly behavioral studies that ignore the animal's physiology and the role the relationship between the animal and its physical and emotional environment play too. But for those of us who live and work in the real world, we need to keep in mind that if we focus on just the medical, or just the behavioral, or just the relationship aspects of the problem, we're only doing one third of the job.
You've been listening to a podcast by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, and books about animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavior and bond sites, check out my website at www.mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the content of these podcasts are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music, Molly on the Shore, by Percy Granger, is used with permission from Catova Arts, www.catova.com.